Over the course of the last two decades, we've learned much more about the growing reality of kids who engage in the practice of self-injury and self-harm. Whether you know it or not, all of us know kids who are dealing with emotional pain by inflicting harm on their bodies. How can we recognize the symptoms of self-harm and then lead kids to hope and healing? We'll be talking with Dr. Mark Penner about hope and healing for kids who cut and much more on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Everybody, it's always fun to welcome you to another episode of Youth Culture Matters. We've had a lot of fun doing this podcast, talking about things that are happening in the world of children, teens, and young adults. And as always, I'm joined today by Jason Sochnick. Jason is working with us here at CPYU on associate staff. I introduce you all the time, Jason. People should know you by now, but I'm glad you're here.
So.
In case anybody's listening for the first time, I want them to know that you are on our associate staff and helping us with our sexual integrity initiative and running Project 619 out there in Spokane, Washington.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Hey, we're coming down to the end of the summer here,
transitioning into the fall here. And I guess you're doing the same thing there, right? We're on the same calendar,
right.
Yeah.
Tell
me a little bit about the lay of the land up there. I've been up there, but you know, here we get just brilliant hardwood colors as the trees drop their leaves. I'm assuming it's the same thing there. I know some places on the West Coast not. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's beautiful. It's one of my favorite time of the year. Yeah, it's just beautiful. The smells, the just getting out, seeing some of the sunsets are just amazing. So.
Yeah. When I get to this time of year, it just always reminds. It just smells, feels, looks like Friday night high school football. I just love that. It's just, what a great memory.
Yes.
Yeah. And when you hear the cicadas, do you have cicadas out there? You know what?
No,
cicadas
we don't have cicadas.
Yeah. Oh,
no,
man.
No.
I usually hear in August. Man, they just start up, and it's an amazing thing to listen to at night. It's just, and we've got some places where the woods are pretty dense, and you drive through there, and the sound is deafening. Biblical proportions, cicadas, right?
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, the other thing, too, that we don't have that a lot of other places in the country have are fireflies. We don't get fireflies
really?
In too many places. I've been to a few places, but honestly, it's more of a Midwest, East thing.
Man, you missed out on one of the greatest evening things about childhood, catching lightning
right?
bugs.
Yeah.
Inhumane, torturous. you get a jar and just poke a bunch of holes in the top of the metal lid and you fill it up. Yeah.
Yep.
Oh man. Hey, how's your summer been? Have you had a good summer?
It's been great.
What have you done?
So, yeah.
Anything special? Downtime?
I haven't gotten to enjoy it quite yet. I'm getting ready to really enjoy vacation here in another couple of days. But this summer has been good in the sense that I've been able to get a ton of housework done. I'm sure you and maybe some of the people listening can recognize how great it feels when you are actually able to get the work that you want or have envisioned done. And so my wife and I, Emily and I, have been working diligently to get walls painted, to get decorations up. We bought a house in January, and it's taken us this long to be able to get to the place where we're actually getting pictures up and getting or having the house become our home. And so it's been a lot of fun.
What have
you guys been up to?
Well, we've traveled a little bit. We've had, you know, some family vacation. There's a lake that we go to that we love, and you know, that's been a lot of fun. And I had a chance to do some teaching down in the southern part of the country here with some youth workers. And then, you know, a big thing, and I know you've gone through this with your dad. This is not meant to be a downer, but my mother-in-law went to be with Jesus back in January at the age of 91. And And I know your dad's living, but you are cleaning out his house and helping him transition to another point in life. And we're doing the same now with Lisa's mom's house in terms of cleaning it out. So that's been an interesting process and been difficult, you know, at many levels. But, you know, the Lord, not to over-spiritualize here, but the Lord's been, I heard Lisa talking about it this morning to someone who came in, and the Lord's been good in terms of, it's been therapeutic. You know, she saved a lot of things, and we're not talking about saving a lot of junk, but she saved a lot of sentimental things like greeting cards. We estimate there were probably boxes, but about 5,000 greeting cards she had received over the years, and some of them were very old. And so there was a lot of time taken just to read through that. So I mean, you know the history of that. It's it really is. And she was a journaler, not so much in a journal book like you or I might do, but just little notes here and there, and literally hundreds of those things that were prayers, Bible verses, thoughts she had had about faith and life. And so at some point, I would love to be able to take that pile and catalog it and put it in some sort of organized format for people to benefit from. So yeah, it was good.
That's excellent.
So Chris,
I can see how
Chris has been. Chris has been working here pretty hard, and he's been working on some difficult things at home this summer, right, Chris?
Oh yes.
A couple of basement floods.
Yeah.
Caused by different things. One by air conditioning unit. Another one by.
By the water heater.
Faulty hot water heater. So we've been having to do some damage, you know, mental damage control with Chris as he's been. We've all been there with that. That stuff is just, talk about fix, you know, get your house where you want it.
And then well, you said we've
undone,
all been there. I haven't been there quite yet. So
okay.
I'm hoping that I don't have to be there anytime soon.
The joys of home ownership.
Yeah, call Chris. He'll be able to walk you through that. But Chris, you before Jason and I get chatting about youth culture here, do you got anything for us?
Good question. Sure, I've got a question for you.
Okay.
I know, well, you currently have a dog, and Jason, you don't have a pet right now, but you've had dogs in the past, is that correct?
Yeah, I've had. Alrighty. We've had dogs,
so, you know, that Secret Life of Pets movie just recently, you know, came out, I don't know, maybe a month or so ago.
I haven't seen it.
Doesn't matter if you've seen the movie or not. But so think back, Jason, to your to a dog that you had and Walt, your current dog.
Yeah.
If you could ask your pet, your dog, one question, what would that question, and they could answer you, you know, in English, what would that question be? What would you be interested in asking your pet?
Oh, man. Well, right now, he's getting a little old. Sully's getting a little old. I think he just turned 13 or 14. And I actually have two questions for him, and they're both related to physical things. And I know you let him out last week. I'm not asking about that.
Chris, you've got to explain what your dog is, too.
How can I admit that we had two golden retrievers that were just these big, beautiful, manly dogs, and they both died horrific deaths at a young age. One just fell over dead with a heart attack at age 4. The other one was 5 years old and got into some poison somewhere in a barn nearby, we think. And we had to put him down. That was just miserable. And so we went, we got a, when we got this dog we have now, 13 years ago, I would only walk him in the neighborhood at night when it was dark and everybody was in the house and asleep, because I felt it wasn't real manly. He's a cockapoo, but he's a big cockapoo, you know, as cockapoos go, and he's, you know, he acts like a big dog, but it was embarrassing.
I enjoy that you had to build up. I thought it was just going to be a simple answer. I have a cockapoo.
I had to justify the
purchase of a cockapoo.
I did. You didn't live through this with me. It was really devastating and hard. I'm grieving the death of these two wonderful dogs, and this is what we get. But he's been a great dog. By the way, last week we were away, and the person who was letting the dog out couldn't let the dog out, so we got Chris to go over and let the dog out. And he texted me right away and asked me, the dog was eating something in the backyard. I won't say what it was, but he asked if that was normal, if the dog always does that. So my question might be to the dog today, you know, what were you thinking when Chris was there? But he's old enough now that we think he's going deaf. Well, he is, and not only that, but when you look him in the eye, I don't know if he has cataracts, but his eyes are kind of cloudy. Were you looking for a real positive answer to this question? Do you want me to keep going with this one? Okay. But I would ask him now, you know, can you hear me? Can you see me? And I think he's old enough and smart enough. He is a doggone smart dog to just have selective hearing and seeing, because when it gets late at night and he wants that biscuit, he sees everything, you know, his bedtime biscuit. And he sees and hears everything, and he's right there, you know, right there with you. So I think he's faking us out, but I do want to know. Tell me the truth. Can you see me? Can you hear me? It's like being a dad.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, you're that way with your kids.
You're waiting for them to turn three or four to finally start communicating.
Well, no, when they're teenagers.
Why they're
can
crying.
You see me? Can you hear me? What's the problem here?
Oh, you know, it's been so long since I've had a dog. I'm trying to think of a question that I would have wanted to ask when I was younger. And the last dog that I had, you want to talk about being embarrassed. The last dog I had was a Lhasa Apso. I think that's what they're called.
Oh, yeah. My apologies, Danny. That's not a dog.
Well, it was found when I was in college, and a bunch of girls found him. His name was Colby. They found him near this trash can near a grocery store, and they started taking care of him. And then the owner of the house they were living in said no. And so then we ended up getting him, me and a roommate in college. And so I took care of him for 6 months, 6 months, 8 months, something like that. And, you know, I think that we took road trips. He drove with me all the way down to Arizona and then drove with me back, because I went down to Arizona for the summer.
Just the two of you.
In between, I think. I think it was like between my junior and senior year in college.
How much driving did he do?
He probably did quite a bit, because I drove all over. I spent a lot of time in the backcountry. But anyways.
You didn't get that question.
I'm trying to think of a question. I don't know. The one thing that would come to mind is you know, what is the one thing you like most with regards to food? Because we'd give him all these different types of food. We weren't really sure what he enjoyed. And sometimes he'd eat something one day, and then that next day or 2 days he wouldn't eat it at all. He was just a very selective eater. So I probably would have wanted to find out, like, and typically you just buy one food, but he was going days after we bought one food and he wouldn't eat it. And so we're like, oh, maybe he needs other dog food. I don't know. I've not had that many dogs, so I didn't know what was going on. So that would probably be it. Is, you know, what do you like? What do you not like? That would be probably one of the questions that I would most want to ask. And with that,
stunning. That was I was really expecting something great from you on that. I mean, that was okay.
But I was expecting the question to maybe be something
blame it.
What would your dog say about you?
Oh yeah.
And I said, the thing I was actually thinking with regards to that question was, how come this guy always sings? He's always singing. Like I will wake up in the morning and I sing all sorts of songs, and sometimes they, like, I'm getting the Cheerios out, you know, it's like, and then I start rapping Cheerios.
Well, in that case, your dog would not say, how come this guy sings, or how come this guy doesn't stop singing? Yeah. Oh, man.
So, anyways.
I know. Dogs, this is a crazy thing about pets. They will look at you. Dogs and cats, they will look at you all day, and you wonder what they're thinking about what you're doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't know about cats. I don't think cats really care. Dogs, maybe. Cats are, like, I'm sorry. I can't own a cat.
I said the same thing, and then your daughter rescues one and winds up living at your house. And yeah, but they cats stare, they're spooky, because you're just wondering, what are you thinking, you know?
Anyway. All right, what kind of youth culture news do you guys
look at this. He's moving us along.
Well, he's moving us on.
We got to stop talking about pets. So,
all right.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the things that are trending, Jason.
So one of the things that I find really interesting with regards to social media was something that came out of Toronto just recently. There were a bunch of teens that were a part of a program that were looking at mental health, and they were part of a therapy session there in Toronto. And they actually took selfies and then created a whole imagery around the selfie that they took, really looking beyond the lens. Like, what was really going through their mind? Because so often what we see in the selfies is we want to portray ourselves in a very positive way. And this whole art show that's taking place in Toronto really was trying to show what's beyond the picture. And so there are a number of different teens that were talking about what was really going on in the selfies that they were doing. It was an art therapy group that was looking and trying to create pieces that play out the ideas of what the selfies are and what they represent online and the images that they had. One that really stood out to me, if you check out the link that will be on our page with regards to this podcast, is Roshan Williams. He was 18, and it looked at the dynamic of what you see and what you don't see. And he said, most people see a good side of me, like a light side, but there is always this slightly darker side with the emotions and how I'm feeling, and they don't always get conveyed the way I would like. And I just think it's so representative of the youth that we are engaging, the teens that we have the privilege of being able to invest in, the young men and women that we get opportunities day in and day out to walk with. And if you're a parent, your son or your daughter. And so it just reveals what's happening often when we look at what's on Instagram or Facebook, but really going beyond that picture, because that picture does not tell the entire story of what's going on in the lives of that son or daughter or child or teen. And I just really appreciate art exhibits like this that are actually going further and actually exposing what's beyond the surface.
Yeah, we can't always believe what the picture's saying, because the pictures are curated, and
yes,
kids and adults as well are trying to put their best foot forward. And, you know, I often am worried, because that in the church, that undermines Christian community, because you're creating a false self that you have to hold up when you're together with people, and you can't really be yourself and be vulnerable about the hurt and pain in your life. You know, image is really an important thing, and this is another trend that I think is worth noting and worth tracking with, and that is, who are the mainstream, most popular people among teenagers in terms of who's out there in the public consciousness? And some research has been done recently in Finland by an independent research company where they interviewed 500 Finnish teens, and I think this is representative of the global youth population. These are kids 13 to 17 years old, and they asked them to name the 3 to 5 celebrities that they follow regularly. And we know that celebrities are out there everywhere because of social media. And there were a couple of outcomes from this that were really interesting. One is that 12 of the top 20 celebrities that these kids said they followed were actually not conventionally famous people who had been made famous through film or television or the music industry, but rather they were online creators who had put up their own YouTube videos, YouTube stars, who pursued fame and actually achieved fame. Only 3 of the top 20 celebrities that listed in this list had a background in television. No, absolutely no Hollywood movie stars on the list. Now, what does this mean? You know, why is this important? Well, you see how that fame is now something that anybody can pursue by creating a YouTube channel. They don't necessarily achieve it. Very few kids achieve it. It's like, you know, getting from the youth basketball court in the local rec league into the NBA. It's a minuscule population, a percentage that gets in. But that doesn't mean that you don't pour your whole life into trying to get there. And I think that kids today are pursuing celebrity and fame as opposed to humble integrity and a life of service to others. It's become very narcissistic. And this is a time and a life waster. And I'm just going to say, youth workers, talk to your students about this. Do you want to pursue your identity in Christ or your online identity? Where do you want to be, quote unquote, successful? And the culture tells us one thing, that fame and fortune, celebrity, achieving that status is what makes you successful. The gospel is totally different, that the successful person really is one who is faithful and obedient to Christ. So we need to push back on this cultural trend.
Yeah, and I really appreciate what you say about looking to Scripture, because that's really unchanging. And so often what celebrity is constantly changing in our culture. And this is just but one more trend, one more reason to be aware of that. Something that we always talk about at Project 619 is looking at what is being said, what is being shared. And I think one of the most important things we can do is being very clear when it comes to sex and sexuality, speaking that in our home, speaking it very clearly in our church youth groups. As practitioners, I think we've got to recognize the role that we play, both as youth worker and as parent, in giving information around sex and sexuality and relationship. And there is a recent podcast that I was listening to from This American Life, which is through NPR. If you're not familiar with it,
that's a good one.
You can look at the link. It's a great one, and it tells stories from America. And one that really stood out to me recently, over the summer, that I had a chance to listen to on a run, was it was named The Birds and the Bees, and the first they do them in acts, and the first act really looked at this idea of sexual assault, something that gets discussed quite often in our culture and is happening more often, or at least being communicated a lot more often. And one of the things that stood out in this podcast was how little a lot of these college students knew about what sexual assault was, or going further, what consent was. And I think that this is the role that we have both as parents and as youth workers, to be both aware of this, but to also then communicate consent, communicate boundaries, communicate a moral code that is not often being discussed. Because what we're entitled to do or called to do is to engage as parents in the world around us and to set our values before them, especially as we look at things Christianly, as we look at Scripture. And I think that this show, what it showed specifically, was that most of the education that many of the students receive does not come from the home or from a church or even sometimes from school. It comes from pornography. And that has a tremendous influence on our culture. And I just think that we need to be aware of the stories that are being told to our sons and our daughters, and that we can actually have the opportunity to be the ones that tell the stories, to shape the values, to challenge our youth to think Christianly about these things.
Yeah, necessary talking points. And again, I'm not saying to people track with pornography, but track with pornography's effects, and it's having a profound effect on our culture and our kids. Hey, one of our associate staff guys here, Paul Robertson, I remember years ago, you know, Paul and I talk a lot about the books we're reading. When we talk on the phone, one of the first questions that he'll ask me is, hey, what are you reading lately? Or I'll ask him, you know, what are you reading lately? And I've learned a lot about a lot of great books that I picked up and taken time with from Paul. Paul said to me one time, you know, leaders are readers, readers are leaders. And I think that's really true. One of the best ways to educate ourselves morally, one of the best ways to educate ourselves in terms of our faith development, just to become aware of what's happening in the world around us as well, is by reading. And unfortunately, reading, there's been a bit of a demise, it seems, in reading, especially among the young. They're spending more time online or doing online reading or playing games. They're not spending as much time sitting and reading books. And even, we'll talk about this in another time, the way that reading on a screen is different from reading on the printed page. Well, let's just talk about reading and reading books. Common Sense Media recently released a challenge to parents on how to nurture your child's love of reading. And I'll just pass along just a couple of pointers that they've given. And most people know this, I'm sure, but I want to remind you of these things and really take the time on a daily basis to read with your kids or to get your kids reading. So here are some pointers from them, some best tips for nurturing a love of reading that they say can last a lifetime. Read aloud. You know, sit together and read a book aloud. Another would be to savor the series. You know, there's so many great series out there of books, and to find a series and have kids read it. For me, it was The Hardy Boys when I was growing up. There were some other series that I read as well. I loved to read when I was a kid. I spent a lot of time reading. I still love to read. And reading series of books is a great thing because it keeps stories going and keeps you engaged. Grab onto a genre is another recommendation that they make, that, you know, maybe your kids are interested in detective stories, nature stories, science fiction, fantasy, whatever. You know, grab onto a genre. And then find books about the things that your kids love. Once you start to see what your kids' interests are, feed them books. Give them ideas on certain titles and certain books or even certain series that would address those interests. So get your kids reading. That's just an important, important discipline to engage in that will become a lifetime pursuit.
Well, speaking of reading, I think the power of story is something that we should also discuss. I recently came across a story, article that was talking about some of the ways in which we describe some of the many things that are happening in our lives, and that a lot of the stories that we impart in today's world typically deal with fear, typically deal with vices, rather than stories of old, which really dealt with virtue, like prudence, justice, temperance, courage, faith, hope, charity. The list goes on and on, yet so often some of the many stories that we read about and that we reflect on and that we engage really deal a lot more with fear. And this particular author was just talking about what their responsibility was in the media or in advertising, and that they needed to start using their skills in a way that actually better society, not just reflect the horrible aspects of society. And I think that that's something that's really important for us to remember, especially as youth practitioners, as youth workers, as parents. What are the stories that we're telling? How are we telling the stories? Yes, there is horrible things that are happening in this world. There are evils that occur. But how are we going to share those stories? I think that's what matters. And I think that we find ways to impart value. That's the one thing that you and I often talk about, is in the midst of all of the soup that these youth that we work with are swimming in, how do we engage it? How do we part the seas, if you will, to be able to tell stories that impart our virtues? And I think that as Christians, this is incredibly important, especially in this day and age. And so I always try to remember the stories that I'm telling, why I'm telling them, and then find ways to engage or impart values, especially as a parent. I think that's one of the best places, is in the home, to be able to have a story that actually then imparts the values that we find very important. And so I think that we just got to be reflective of that.
So when we get back to what we talked about before with reading, we want to look for good stories that have positive values that build character.
Yes.
And a lot of that we would find in the classics. So
yes.
I think just going back and looking at some things, and there's new stuff like that as well, but certainly biblical stories too. That's good. Thanks, Jason, for that. Well, let me give you one more trend here. And I don't know if you want to hear this or not. Now, we've often joked a little bit about our generational differences. You know, me being a baby boomer, you have no idea where you land, right? You say you're kind of on the edge between Gen X and millennials. Where are you today? Do you know where you are today on that? Or because that matters here with this story. Where are you going to land?
By age, I land by Gen X.
You're safe then.
Yeah, but millennial Gen X, I'm right on that bridge.
Okay, you're safe. You're safe today because I thought this was really interesting. Now, I don't know how you grew up, but one of the things my dad taught me was to have a very firm handshake. So anytime he would shake my hand, it would be, hey, that's a good handshake, or stop shaking hands like it's a dead fish. So I've always been conscious my whole life of when I shake someone's hand, trying to get a good grip. In fact, I actually reboot handshakes from time to time. You know, like if your hand doesn't get in there all the way. Well, the reason I'm talking about this is, did your dad teach you this stuff too?
You call it a reboot. I love it.
Yeah. Did your dad teach you this stuff, have a firm handshake?
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it was really important.
And here's the problem. There's a story that's come out about some research that's been done. There's actually, this is crazy when you think about it. There's actually a Journal of Hand Therapy. So in the Journal of Hand Therapy, there is a story about some research that was done. They tested 237 millennials, men ages 20 to 34, and women in their early 20s, and they found that they had significantly weaker hand grips than the young people tested in 1985. And women in their late 20s were weaker in their right, but not their left hands. Now, this is all kind of weird. But the reason they're talking about it is that hand strength seems to be an indicator of getting soft elsewhere. So it could be a sign of general flabbiness in a generation, they're saying, that does more texting and clicking than manual labor. So all this to say, you know, we need to think about stewardship of our physical bodies. And we've talked a lot through our Digital Kids Initiative here about, you know, does all this activity, being engaged with screens all the time, limit our physical activity and thereby make us weaker human beings physically? So this seems to be saying, yes, that's the case. So we need to take some time to make sure that we're
we're exercising, especially for millennials. So that's bad news for millennials. But I'm going to continue to work on my good handshake.
Work on your handshakes.
I
was in a workshop. I was in a workshop one time a while back that was talking about the power of handshake, and it was really interesting. They were given all these different handshakes and what they meant and the psychology around them. And I remember one that stood out was if you reach your hand out, because sometimes people do the handshake with like one over yours, and they kind of, instead of it being sideways,
so
it's like one
the
over
top,
the top. Yeah. And they're talking about like that, the more dominating person will come from the top and shake your hand that way rather than from the side where it's a mutual friendship. And yeah. That's always been something that I find really interesting.
Next time
I see you.
You'll become the alpha. Hey, you might be surprised to know this, but this thing is so much in my head from the time I was born that I actually have, if you get in my car with me and you look over in the driver's side door down in that little pocket, you know, underneath the handles and all the buttons and things, I actually have a hand gripper in there, a spring hand gripper that I'll oftentimes use when I'm driving.
I have one on my desk at the office. Yeah, I do that all the time.
You need to start using it more, Jason. I'm telling you. You don't want to be this bad guy. Yeah.
Well,
this is good. We need to talk about these things. And as we always say, you know, Bible in one hand, newspaper in the other. Let's think about how God's Word speaks to all these issues. And we'll continue in future podcasts to talk about trends. But now, before we're going to take a break. But before that, I just want to let you know, when we come back, we're going to have a really significant conversation on really a troubling trend, and that is the rise in self-injury among teenagers and among adults with our good friend, Dr. Marv Penner. Marv actually is, I believe, world-renowned in his knowledge of this trend, and Marv's going to help us unpack this, not only understand it, but look at some ways to respond. So hang in there with us. We'll be back after the break to talk about self-injury with Marv Penner. In an effort to help you help the kids you know and love navigate the difficult landscape of the emerging digital frontier to the glory of God, we've launched a digital kids initiative here at CPYU. Thanks to a generous grant from a company called DAS, you can access our digital kids initiative and a growing number of free resources and downloads by visiting the website at digitalkidsinitiative.com. This is one more way that we're helping you lead your kids to live lives where their faith in God is integrated into the growing amount of time they're spending with social media and technology. Well, welcome back, everybody, to this episode of Youth Culture Matters. And we've got a great interview today. You know, Jason, I've been thinking back as we get ready to talk to my good friend Marv Penner about self-injury, thinking back to when I graduated from high school. I spent a few years, I don't even think this would happen now with someone as young as I was, but working in a private psychiatric hospital outside of Philadelphia on the adolescent ward. And we had about 15 patients in there at any given time. And on any given day, we had at least one young person who would cut themselves. And we were supposed to chart that. And at the time, this was, the mid-1970s, we were told by the psychiatric staff to chart that, and we were always told to list it as a suicide attempt or a suicidal gesture. That was the language I remember them telling us to use. Since then, we've learned a lot about that what we were seeing happen at that point in time was not really a suicidal gesture or a suicide attempt, but rather it was an attempt to deal with some other things, and that's what we've come to understand about self-injury. Marv has been studying this for years. Marv's worked with students and their families in a ministry capacity and in counseling in some way for about 45 years now. And one of the areas of expertise that Marv has developed is in the area of self-injury. So, Marv, welcome. I am so glad you're here, and that's what we want to talk about today is self-injury. You've got this great book, Hope and Healing for Kids Who Cut, Learning to Understand and Help Those Who Self-Injure. We'll come back and talk about that in a little bit. Tell us just a little bit about your experience with this and how you've seen this whole understanding of self-injury, just as I described there in terms of my own experience, how you've seen this morph and change over the years.
Well, actually, my experience is very similar to yours. I was working in a youth ministry setting in a church, and on rare occasions would stumble upon this behavior, which, as you indicated, we interpreted as some sort of a suicidal gesture. Then I moved on to a college campus, began teaching as a college professor, so was surrounded by young adults, my office kind of had an open door, and I was dealing with these kinds of things in the classroom, and so students would stop by, and I just began to see more and more of it. It was probably in the mid to late 90s that I really saw this thing exploding, then I began to recognize that this was something different than what we had originally interpreted it as, and so I went on a quest to try to find as much information on this, what I considered to be a bizarre behavioral phenomenon at that point. My search kind of came up empty. There was nothing that was being written about it. The internet just didn't have a whole lot of information. As it turned out, I ended up doing, I suppose, by accident or by instinct, something that's turned out to be really productive, and that is that I learned about self-injury from self-injurers. I just became a student of their hearts, tried to ask them questions that would help me understand what was going on. So much of what I've learned about self-injury has come from the first-person accounts of kids who have been involved in this behavior. Same as you, stumbled onto it, didn't know what it was, and then learned all I could from talking to kids who were willing to trust their hearts to me and share their stories.
Marv, is it reasonable to assume that anybody who's a teacher or anybody who's a youth worker, they've got kids in their community, in their group, in their classroom, who self-injure?
Yeah, it's pretty safe. Let me give you a little surprising insight on that. When I stand up in front of a room full of adults and ask them, do any of you know people who self-harm? The response is often, kind of lukewarm. I'll see maybe a quarter of the hands in the room go up. When I stand in front of a room full of teenagers and say, do you guys have friends who self-injure? Raise your hands if you do. Virtually every single hand goes up in the room. When I teach college courses now, and I teach courses at various colleges on adolescents at risk and counseling adolescents, that sort of thing, honestly, I have never taught a college course where I don't have, I would say, probably about a quarter of the people in the room who have some self-injury in their background. It's everywhere. I think people can assume that it's a very real issue, either for the people who are there or certainly for their friends, people that they know.
Marv, do you, just because there's a lot of individuals that are going to be listening that don't know what self-injury is, could you describe what self-injury is so that way those that are listening might have a better idea?
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing you need to know is that, I mean, self-injury, the term itself is quite self-explanatory, that in fact, someone is doing physical harm to their bodies. But what maybe we didn't understand about self-harm until more recently is that self-harm actually is in the mind of the person who's doing it, a behavior that's experienced as self-care. That essentially the motivation behind the self-harm is to somehow alter a mood state, to somehow change what they're feeling emotionally. And let me just say that after having countless conversations with hundreds of kids who self-harm, they will tell you that it is profoundly effective in achieving that outcome. They will tell me that when I hurt myself, and there are various forms of it, we can talk about that in a moment, but when I put the blade to my skin, when I punch my thighs, when I put that hot item on my skin to burn it, immediately my mood, my emotions change. And it happens in two different ways. Either it takes emotions that are overwhelming and feeling like they're going to result in some sort of an emotional meltdown or explosion. And when the self-harm takes place, all of that craziness goes away. Or the other side of it is kind of the opposite, is I feel numb, I feel detached, I feel like I don't even know if I'm alive or not. And when I engage in self-harm, it reminds me that I'm alive. It stirs up for me some emotions that probably I wasn't conscious of until I began the behavior. So emotional management is at the heart of it. I'm trying to change how I feel, and the way I'm doing that is by inflicting harm to my body that's serious enough to do injury.
Just from a historical context, I'm really interested in, because you said mid-90s when you started finding this out, and
yeah,
what you thought it was then and what it is now. I'm just curious what you thought it was then. When you were first engaging in this, first learning about it, because there was something that you had said early on just about maybe it was the reasons why or what it was. And so I would love to just hear from a historical context what that was.
Well, let me say a couple of things historically, Jason. The first thing is that we just made the assumption, and this has been the case, ever since I've been involved in working with kids since the late 60s, that when someone is doing harm to their body, they have a destructive motivation. And so we just assumed that this was some sort of a suicide gesture. In fact, I wonder if our suicide attempt stats from back in the mid-1900s are really seriously skewed. Because we chalked any kind of self-harm up as a suicide attempt. And I think we were seriously misinterpreting things at that point. In fact, I've talked to a lot of people who are older, who are, in their 50s, 60s, and even 70s now, who self-harmed during the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And they affirm that it was not a suicide attempt. They were actually simply trying to find a way to survive. And so we've discovered that self-harm is actually the opposite of suicide. Instead of being a way to end life, they're actually trying to find a way to prolong survival. It's a way of getting through the day. It's a way of making it one more day. Now, there's one more really important historical piece, and that is the frequency with which this is happening. So until the mid-90s, there was really nothing available. And then Stephen Levenkron, who was recognized at that point as being the global expert on self-harm, wrote a book. It was kind of the first Barnes & Noble-level book, easily accessible. There had been some academic stuff written prior to that. But Levenkron wrote this book called Cutting. And in the foreword to the book, he estimates, and based on his expertise, it was probably a legitimate estimate, that about 1 in 250 girls are involved in self-harm. That's less than 0.5%. This is in 1998, don't forget. In 2008, 10 years later, Princeton and Cornell Universities did a research project with their incoming freshman class. And they discovered that 1 in 5 girls, 1 in 7 guys, had been involved in self-harm. So we see a jump there in 10 years from less than 0.5% to 20%. Now, by any measure, that's an epidemic proportionate jump and something that we probably really need to take seriously.
Marv, let me ask you about that, because I think about cultural change, and we're talking about management of emotions, or, you mentioned emotions, you mentioned numbness as two factors, and, as a way to deal with this. Are the emotions, the things that are beneath the emotions that are causing this movement towards self-injury, are they on the rise? And
In other words, you know, the base causes of this, are we seeing in our culture, in our families, in our communities, in our schools, and I don't know what, you know, I'll let you talk about what all those things might be, the causal, you know, reasons and factors, are they on the increase? So,
yeah, would it be, well, there's absolutely...
and that said, would it be reasonable to assume, I know you're talking about, you know, people you've spoken to from back in the 1950s, that more and more people are actually doing this now?
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are obviously much greater. And now that we understand that it's a way of managing emotions, it's not hard to look at the rest of what we know about adolescent emotional and mental health and see spikes all over the place. We've never had a more stressed and anxious generation of adolescents by any measure. You know, school officials, guidance counselors, teachers are telling us that that kids are living at an all-time high level of stress and anxiety. Families continue to deteriorate. Communities continue to be dangerous places for kids to grow up. And so the factors that generate the negative emotion, whether it's anxiety, stress, depression, despair, fear, anger, you know, all of those intense negative emotions are certainly being driven to new levels by some of the things that are going on in our world these days. And so the need for kids to medicate somehow becomes really urgent.
Yeah.
And
what are those things? What are those things that are causing the fear, the anxiety, the stress? You know, because one of the things that I had heard years ago when I was reading some of the first literature that came out in these books on self-injury was there seemed to be a common thread, not in all cases, but it tended to be more girls and girls who had experienced some form of sexual abuse.
Sexual abuse is one of the factors that is correlated with self-harm. It's well known that a pretty high percentage of kids who self-harm have been sexually abused. But certainly that's not the only factor. It's linked to any form of negative emotional experience, abandonment, betrayal, guilt, shame, stress. So when you begin to look at all of the brokenness in the world around us, it leaves kids in a place where they may feel like they don't have a lot of options. My concern in all of this, Walt, and I know that this really matters to you folks at CPYU, is that it becomes really easy for us to focus on the symptomology, which in this case, you know, is the behavior that we're talking about today, and recognize that it has a function for managing emotions. But we have to find ways as communities to get behind all of that and say, what can we do about eliminating all of the stress, the anxiety, the fear, the loneliness, the disconnectedness? You know, these are factors that we're going to have to continue to look at. I mean, when you think even, and you've done so much work on this at CPYU, about the digital world and the stresses that that creates for kids. You know, I was just talking to a 15-year-old yesterday who had been involved in a bunch of sexting with a guy in her class. And she looked at me with this incredulous look and she said, "Can you believe he sent it to all the boys in the school?" And I said, "And, you know, that surprises you?" She goes, "I trusted him. She's been alienated. She's been shut out from the social circles that she was a part of. And she's living with massive social stress. She's got the whole summer now to think about it. She doesn't know where she's going to fit when she gets to school in the fall. And she's turned to self-harm as her way of managing that stress right now. So there's a lot of stuff going on for kids. There's no question.
So it's reasonable to assume that this is really just going to escalate even more, because we're really setting the table in our culture for kids to experience their brokenness more and more alone and at deeper and deeper levels based on the kinds of pressures and experiences that they face on a daily basis. And like you said, social media just really pushes on that.
Right. There's no question. And, you know, whether they're going to continue to use self-harm or come up with some other new creative way to manage or medicate, you know, it remains to be seen. But certainly in the present, we're seeing this thing continuing to escalate, partly because in a bizarre way, it's contagious. And when I say contagious, I mean the kids learn from one another, and not only in face-to-face encounters, you know, kids who show each other their cuts in school, you know, that sort of thing. But the online communities are, frankly, it's terrifying to see the way kids are sharing online. If you do a YouTube search on, you know, cutting or self-harm, you will find tens of thousands of videos that are posted there, you know, graphic, many of them instructional for kids, many of them just kind of cathartic as kids are venting their deep pain for each other, you know, in that forum where kids go. So, I mean, literally tens of thousands of videos where kids can just immerse themselves in that world, and a lot of them really, really enthusiastic about how well it works.
Marv, just real quick before we take a break, a question. Do you think it's reasonable to assume that the way adolescent culture functions, and especially in a world of social media, that there are more and more kids right now who are self-injuring, who do not have the kind of brokenness, who have not experienced the kind of trauma that you know, traditionally those who self-harm have experienced, but rather they're doing it as a way to fit in? It's almost faddish, let's say.
Well, I imagine there are probably some like that. But the truth of the matter is, and I mean, you need to know, Walt, I'm an optimistic guy, but kids are hurting today like right. never before. I don't know a lot of kids who aren't living with some pretty significant stress, some pretty significant disappointment in their key relationships. And so, you know, this isn't a matter of, you know, the kids are all right. 95% of them are good. We got this 5% fringe. My experience in working with families, you know, in pretty mainstream environments, you know, I live in a normal community. I, you know, work in schools, I work in churches. And I would just suggest, to you and our listeners, that most of the kids around us are hurting much more deeply than they or we are willing to admit, that they're masters at hiding that pain. And when they've buried it and it's something they carry all by themselves, they have to go to these kinds of behaviors where they can, just as they are lonely in their carrying of their pain, they're lonely in their trying to manage it. And I think that's the reality that we're living with.
And so what we want to do is, after we take a break, is come back and talk about that, how to recognize symptomatically what's happening and then peel back the layers to see what's at the root of it and
yeah.
step in, no matter who we are, youth workers, teachers, parents, step in to start them on the path of, like, what we like to call, Marv, hope and healing. So we're
exactly.
going to take a break here. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Here at the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, we want to help you stay up to date on today's youth culture. One of the tools we've developed to keep you current is our weekly Youth Culture e-Update. Delivered to you by email, our Youth Culture e-Update comes to you in a format that allows you to easily scroll through and quickly choose those stories and resources that will be most helpful to you in your particular setting. To sign up for this free resource, go to our website at cpyu.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and enter your email address in the tab marked E-Update Sign Up. It's that simple. Well, welcome back, everybody. We're having a great discussion on this episode of Youth Culture Matters. It's actually a discussion I wish we didn't have to have. None of us do. But it's with our good friend Marv Penner, and it's on the issue of self-harm and kids, adults as well, something we need to really be aware of, and Marv's become an expert on that. So we're going to continue that discussion in just a couple of minutes here to talk more about some of the symptoms, ways to look for this, identify it, and then how to get on the road, the path to hope and healing. But first, let's have a little fun with Marv. Marv, you've done this before, so you know what to expect. We do this little segment called Take Five, where we ask you five questions. You don't know what they are right off the top of your head. You've got to answer them. It's a way for us to get to know you and for the folks who are listening to know a little bit more about you. And by the way, as always, we're going to include all kinds of links on this podcast, any books that are mentioned, and even some links on some ways to get to know Marv and what he's doing. And how to bring him to your church or to your community to speak on this and other matters as well. We'll include that on the page for this podcast. So here we go, Marv. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right. First one. Go. Number one, if you could play one instrument that you're not playing now, what would it be? If you could learn to play
banjo.
One instrument.
The banjo. There's no question. It's the happiest instrument in the world. My kids bought me one for my birthday a couple of years ago. It's hanging in my office. I have dabbled.
That's not helpful.
I want to play the banjo.
There you go. And we have our good buddy Wayne Rice who could teach you how to do that.
I know. I've talked to him about it.
He's world class. He's iconic. It's amazing.
Exactly.
It's another part of Wayne, one of the founders of Youth Specialties. All right. Number two, Marv, what is your favorite record album of all time?
I think
a turntable there. You can drop it on. What is it?
It is probably the Beatles' Abbey Road album. I get that
because that's iconic. I mean, that's part of our childhood. You remember just playing that over and over again.
Yeah, we could talk about the Eagles, too. Or of course, the Statesman Quartet. Let's stick with the Eagles.
Who or what they are, but I'm not going to fuss. Okay, number three, Marv, best car you've ever had. What's the best car you've ever had?
Oh, there's no question. It's a car that I have right now. It is a Volvo C70 convertible. I live in a world of sunshine up here in British Columbia and Canada. And there is nothing I love more than to put the top down, turn the music up, and head on down the highway.
That's surprising. I thought that, like, there's 23 hours of darkness per day in Canada. I guess I'm wrong on that, huh?
You certainly are.
Yeah, all right.
Sun went down last night at 9:30 p.m. We're just fine, thanks.
All right, number four. If you had to change your first name, what would you change it to? And I'm not saying I don't like your first name. I just think this is a great question. Yeah.
I would definitely change it to Walt.
Really? That's funny because I changed mine to Duffy.
Marv, not Walter? You wouldn't go with Walter?
All right. Let's move on to number five. All right. Last question. I can't wait to ask you this one, Marv. Which one of your friends... And look, you can't answer it the same way you answered the last one. One of your friends would make the best U.S. president and why?
Oh, Duffy Robbins.
I thought that was it.
Without a doubt. I don't know anyone who is more politically informed. That would be Duffy's job. No question about it. In fact, I would be surprised if he's not secretly aspiring to it.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking of writing him in this November. I don't know. I'm thinking about it. But my fears are the laws he would enact regarding food. because
yeah, that's right.
They would be, you know, like outlaw pizza and all those other good things. But okay, good,
that's right.
Good.
No, he'd be
well,
great.
You guys might need to buy yard signs for Duffy.
Yeah, you did.
So
that was good. Good answer, Sarah Marth. I like that.
All right.
Well, hey, as we transition from the Take Five, I want to come back to what we were talking about right before the break. And I want to dive into some of the symptoms, recognizing symptoms, so that way we those that are listening have a better understanding and a better idea of how to both recognize, and then we'll get here shortly to the path to healing. But before we do so, what are some symptoms that we need to be on the lookout for as youth workers?
Well, actually, you know, there are sort of two categories here, Jason. One is symptoms we can be on the lookout for as youth workers. The other is symptoms we can be on the lookout for as parents, because we kind of have these two different worlds in which we experience kids.
Yes.
So let me talk about youth workers first. Obviously, if we see the physical cuts, if we see the bruises, very often on the upper thighs, kids will very often sit and pound. Bruises on their heads. Boys will very often headbang. Small, little C-shaped burns. The way a lot of guys self-harm is they'll take a disposable lighter and turn it kind of on its side, ignite it, and then that heats up the little metal shroud that's around the flame to the point where it becomes like a little branding iron. And so they'll brand themselves on their skin with that. So obviously seeing the injuries themselves. Now, be prepared for kids to make all kinds of excuses. It was the cat. I was walking in the woods and got into some thorns and that caused it. So kids will very often have excuses, but, you know, that's an obvious one. The second thing is when kids are wearing long sleeves or long pants in really hot weather, they seem to be really careful about keeping their sleeves pulled down in weather where, you know, most of the kids are wearing short sleeves or tank tops or whatever, you know, that would certainly be an indication. And then, of course, blood seeping through on sleeves or upper thighs. The common places for kids to cut, if that's the form of self-injury they choose, is on their lower arms or up on their shoulders, on their upper thighs, or on their tummies. And so if ever you see any indication of blood seeping through, you know, dried blood, that sort of thing, that would be a reason to be concerned. And by the way, let me just say to youth workers, one of the most common questions I get asked is, if I see that a kid's cutting, I see evidence of that, should I say something? And the answer is, of course you should say something. And you don't have to make a big deal. Just say, hey, I couldn't help but notice when your sleeves lift up there, you know, that there's a bunch of cuts on your arm. I would love to talk with you about what was going on for you when you did that. So open the conversation. I mean, assuming that you have a relationship with a student, that would be the entirely appropriate thing to do. Now, well, let's go to the home environment, because there we have a few more levels of clues that we can look for. One is that there's first aid equipment in a child's bedroom. So Band-Aids or... sanitizing ointments or, you know, that sort of thing. If those are there, that would be cause for concern. Broken disposable razors. So if you see, in your kid's trash can, a disposable razor with the blades missing, that's a pretty common instrument that's used. If you see in the trash Kleenex or toilet paper that has blood on it, especially if that blood is in straight lines, if when you're doing your kid's laundry on the inside of the sleeves, you see residue of blood that's there, those would be the kind of things. And you know, in many ways, they seem kind of obvious, but I'm astounded at the number of parents who just aren't tuned into it. The other thing, of course, is especially with younger kids, parents should be, aware of what's going on in their kids' world of social media, in the kinds of searches that their kids are doing online. If those computers can remain open to parents, and you see your kids searching for stuff that's related to self-harm, those kinds of things need to be addressed. And again, the best thing that we can do is raise the issue and talk about it. The conversation has to be started. Whether you're a parent, a youth worker, a teacher, open the conversation, give them a chance to talk about it.
Okay, I have one question. Well, two questions, but one first is around age. What's the average age that, because some parents might be listening, some youth workers might be hearing this, and they say, well, it's not going to be an issue until 12 or 13. I mean, you said kids, and so my thought went to even as young as 8, 9, 10. So give some context around age.
And yeah, is it getting younger and younger, age compression?
You know, my assumption is that it is because – As I hear kids talking about it now, they will very often reference first and second grade experiences as their first foray into self-harm. I hear kids talking about, using the sharp edge of a ruler in first grade or when I got my first compass for my geometry set, the point, I'd use that. I talked to a girl just recently who said that on her way to first grade, there was a rough patch of concrete along a wall just before she got to school, and she would shove her knuckles into it and scrape all the skin off her knuckles because she said that was the only way that she could calm her anxiety going into school. So younger, absolutely. This is commonly an issue for kids as young as 8, 9, 10 years old. They tend to be a little more susceptible to social media cues when they're a little older than that. But I'm astounded at the number of people who talk about really young entry into this behavior.
Well, here's the other question then that I would have is excuses. You brought up that they might make excuses. So I'm just really curious how, as a youth worker and as a parent, you handle those excuses. Because you brought up the idea of asking, but how do you handle the excuses that might be shared?
Well, first of all, let me just say, Jason, that I don't think I'm overstating this, but I don't think I've ever met a kid who self-injures who doesn't want to stop. In their deepest place in their heart, they know that this is destructive. They know that it's got to end. They desperately want to stop. And yet they face this sort of crossroads of recognizing that if I stop, then I've got a whole nother set of problems. And so the main excuse that I hear from kids for not wanting to stop is, if I stop, then what am I going to do with my pain? The hurt will continue on, and for now, this is working. Now, of course, it's not working as well as I thought it would. And it is subject to what I call the law of diminishing returns, which means that what managed my emotions yesterday doesn't manage my emotions today. So I got to ramp it up. I got to cut deeper. I got to cut more off, and I've got to bruise myself more aggressively. But if I stop this, then what options do I have? If I stop this, I might find myself slipping towards suicide. I've even had kids say to me, if I stop this, then you won't have any reason to talk to me anymore. Like, right now, I feel like I've got you in my corner. Mm. But if I stop self-harming, then you're going to declare me cured, and we won't be able to talk about what's going on in my life anymore.
And that's just a sign of how desperate kids are for a relationship and someone to talk to.
You mean the fact that they want to talk to me is an indication of how desperate they are?
Well, I actually didn't mean that, but you know what I'm saying. I mean,
I know exactly what you're saying, Walt.
Yeah.
And it is an indication. That certainly is true. There's one more thing, and that is that for some kids, the scars, the cuts are a way of actually pushing people away. These are kids who will sometimes let others easily see their self-injury. And for them, it's a way of keeping people at a distance so that they don't have to get into a relationship that might end up being disappointing in the end. So how do we respond to all of this? We've got to respond relationally. I mean, once again, I think we can, with a high degree of confidence, say that the pain that drives this behavior is relational pain. And so, therefore, the response to it has to be relational as well. And of course, ultimately, we know that the gospel is the only appropriate response, and the gospel is profoundly relational. But as representatives of the good news, we need to affirm these kids in light of their low self-esteem. We need to listen to them in light of, a lifetime of stuffed emotions. Those feelings that they have of being defective in some significant way means that we let them know that they're accepted. The feelings of aloneness, we offer our presence, fully engaged presence. The desperation, the sense of hopelessness that they feel, we become messengers of hope in their lives. We got to respond relationally to these relational realities that have driven this behavior in the first place.
Wow. Well, as we, because you're mentioning a lot of really good ways to respond. I know that you have essentials when it comes to healing, and I would love to hear some of those as we come to a conclusion here in the podcast. But I think that hearing some of those essentials could be really helpful for many of our youth workers and parents that are listening to this.
Yeah, and thanks for asking, Jason, because once again, I just want to acknowledge the many, many teenagers who have helped me discover what a path to hope and healing actually looks like for them. This is a bit of a work in progress for me, because I'm still learning. Every time I talk to a new kid and hear a new story, I learn a little bit more. But here's what I've discovered just in terms of helping kids find a way back to hope and wholeness. Let's call them milestones, if you would. Milestones toward healing. The first milestone is crossed when a kid can look at me and say, "Hey, my story matters. You're listening. Someone is taking my story seriously. I promise you, behind every incident of self-harm, there will be a story that needs to be told, a story that needs to be heard." And for most of these kids, they're not used to anybody having an interest in their story. So when a kid recognizes, "Hey, my story matters," I got to tell you, after 12 years of post-high school education, my most common counseling technique with teenagers is simply to say, "Would you be willing to tell me your story? I would love to hear your story." And that has continued to be the most effective way to connect with kids. So when they can say, "My story matters, somebody's listening," that's kind of milestone number one. Number two is, there is an emotional, let's call it an emotional soundtrack to my story. It's not just a series of events. Very often when kids begin to tell me their stories, it will be like, "Okay, so then I was born in 1997, and then in 1998 we moved, and in 1999 my parents got divorced," and they'll give me this chronology. And I want to keep coming back and saying, "What was going on for you in your heart at that time? What were you feeling? What did that feel like?" Because I want them to know that the emotions in their story, and every Every event in their story has emotions connected with it. Your emotions are really, really important. But I've got to move very quickly from your emotions are important to your emotions are legitimate. They're valid. So when you felt afraid in that situation, when you felt angry in that situation, when you felt alone in that situation, when you felt betrayed, you know what? That's a normal and natural emotional response to those events. So I want to legitimize their emotions that they were feeling, because a lot of these kids feel like, you know, if I can only just get over this, you know, maybe my emotions aren't valid. I want to tell them, no, what you felt was very real for you. It was legitimate. It was valid. But then to move from there, okay, so I've heard their story. We've unpacked the emotions that are there. I've validated those emotions and said, those emotions are legitimate. That's how I would feel if that happened to me. Then I want to say, your desire to manage your negative emotions is a completely normal and healthy human response. Nobody wants to feel angry or lonely or fearful or anxious or stressed or, you know, whatever the list is. Nobody wants to feel that. And for you to try to manage that, of course, that makes you a normal human being. All right, so you've found a way to manage that. You've found a way to make it through another day. There's almost a sense here in which I want to affirm their desire to keep going. But then we have to say, all right, what I've chosen as a way of managing those emotions has actually turned out to be really destructive in many ways. Not just physically destructive, but it's forced me into a secret world. It's been destructive in my friendships. It's been destructive in my family. It's been destructive for me spiritually. And I actually work through them. You know, who's impacted by this and how has it been destructive? We actually make a bullet point list of the ways in which this strategy they've chosen has ended up having all these side effects. I often reference the drug commercials that we see on TV where, you know, the side effects take longer to describe than the positive outcome the drug's going to give them. And I say that's a little bit like self-harm is. Yeah, it addresses this issue in your life, but it's got all this other destructive stuff that comes with it. And they're pretty astute at being able to point that out. And then, of course, you know, the turning point is, am I willing to explore other healthier ways of managing these legitimate emotions? And that's where, you know, we teach them basic communication skills. Do you need to resolve some conflict, et cetera?
Marv, you're describing some great strategies here. The question I would ask is, and I just asked this because, you know, I was a youth pastor and I'd discover something like this happening with kids or something else, and I would want to step in and be the person who could fix it.
Right.
How prepared are parents and youth workers to do this? And I think I know your answer to the question. And based on that, then what is the first step a youth worker or a parent should do? First couple of steps to get kids the help they need. Give or
yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's really easy in this case to be put off by the behavior because it seems so bizarre. It seems so out of the box for some people. I mean, it literally taps their squeamishness about pain and blood and, you know, that sort of thing. And so our first response is just to sort of recoil from it. And that is the least helpful thing. Let's remember, these kids already feel alone and probably defective at some level. And if people demonstrate, a fear or a revulsion, they will very often interpret that as, you know, there's something even more wrong with me than I thought. So we need to ask God for grace to move toward what we see happening as parents. We need to gently and compassionately hear the story, of which at times we are participants in that story. That becomes particularly challenging for us. When kids know that there's someone who's willing to listen, when kids know that there's someone who is not running away, but who is running toward their pain and is willing to stay there with them in it, that makes all the difference in the world. That opens the door to a whole new way of dealing with things. Both as parents and as youth workers, teachers, guidance counselors, whatever role we have in the lives of kids, if we're willing to move toward them, listen to their stories, remain present, even in the face of not knowing what to do next. You know, kids aren't looking for advice or solutions. They're looking for someone to be there with them.
Well, that,
and that's something that all of us can do.
I know we're coming down to the end here time-wise, and that leads me to my last question, and that is, okay, so we know there's an issue. We've built a relationship. Now, obviously, we need to connect the dots and facilitate and support them as they move towards getting the help they need. Counseling.
Yeah.
We need
right.
to look for qualified professional counselors who have dealt with this before, I
right.
assume, and who see the gospel, as you mentioned before, as at the root of the solution, foundational to the solution, rather than, as some counselors, I guess, do, the scriptures and the gospel as part of the problem.
Right.
So just a final word here to youth workers and parents on taking that step and getting the
yeah.
help.
Absolutely. When we're dealing with something as complex as self-harm, particularly when it's moved into becoming habitual or even an addictive behavior, in the vast majority of cases, kids are going to need some sort of professional help to help them work through the complexities, to hold them accountable as they pursue other ways of managing that that painful reality that they're dealing with. And so I would just say, especially for youth workers, make sure that you have a relationship with some trusted counselors, therapists in your community, someone that you can point families to. And as you do that, don't disengage, because your role is still really significant in providing that ongoing pastoral presence, that ongoing friendship, that ongoing support, and perhaps even accountability on some things. Recognize when you're out of your depth, and do the referral for the sake of the family and the kid who's involved, making sure that they get the best help possible. But remain engaged at the level of friendship, prayer support, encouragement, accountability, all of those things that we can do, because kids have trusted us with their stories. Let me just say, Walt, as sort of my last thought here, there is no more precious gift that a teenager gives an adult than the gift of trust. When a teenager trusts an adult and says, "I'm willing to share my story," that's not normal. That's not natural. That's not easy. And I think sometimes as adults, we overlook the significance of what it means when a teenager is willing to share their story with us. That is a precious gift to be stewarded carefully. And we need to be careful that we don't disengage and in the process communicate to them that their story doesn't matter.
Mm. This is good, Marv. Thanks so much for talking to us about this. This is a tough topic. And, you know, whether we know it or not, we have kids, we know kids who self-harm, who self-injure, who cut. So we want to work to resource you here. Marv's recommended, having at arm's length the name of a counselor. Don't wait till the problem happens. Realize that this is going on. And so, take time now in anticipation of having to step into a difficult situation at a moment's notice to get to connect the dots between a family that's struggling and counselors. I'm going to mention as well three resources that we have here at CPYU that Marv has put together, and I'm going to let you know that I'm going to tell you about how to get these at 25% off. The first one is a book. It's called Help, My Kids Are Hurting, A Survival Guide to Working with Students in Pain. It's an excellent, excellent book. Also, Hope and Healing for Kids Who Cut,
This is a great book subtitled Learning to Understand and Help Those Who Self-Injure. Again, this is written by Marv, and a wonderful book. And then Marv's also worked with us to put together an educational resource that's an actual webinar. This is something that you can get from us, and you can drop it in to your computer. You can watch it on your screen. You can project it if you want to use this at a parents' meeting or for youth worker training or just for your own education. It's called, again, Hope and Healing for Kids Who Cut. It's a webinar, and we will put links to all these resources up right now on our website for this podcast. If you use the code SHPODCAST, all capital letters, SHPODCAST, will give you 25% off on either of those books and the webinar. So thanks again to Marv for joining us. And Jason, we'll be back with you again on another episode very soon of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent-Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.